So we've been going through the book of Acts. We've got 2 weeks left of the book of Acts. We're going to wrap it up between today and next Sunday. And Pastor Chris just did a really nice job of doing an excellent recap all the way through. So if you missed that one, I would encourage you to take a look back at that December 27th. He really walked us through kind of from that beginning all the way up to where we're at now. I'm not going to do that whole thing again. And then what we saw, this theme that Chris was bringing to play, and it comes back into today, and it's really, it's this overriding theme throughout the book of Acts. And it's that God is establishing his church. And you see people that are at work in establishing this church. You saw Peter early on. The first part of the book was all about all these works of Peter. And he was preaching these messages and he was going to these places. And we saw Peter have this vision. And when he had this vision, it kind of converted where he's going from the Jews now. He's switching over to the Gentiles, saying that this gospel is also for the Gentiles, which was mind-blowing to this culture at the time. And then we saw a transition to some of the Gentile believers. We saw this really cool dynamic, and it was hard, but when you see Stephen is stoned, and that created fear within the church, and what did they do? They actually scattered. But by scattering, and this is what Chris pointed out very quickly, he was hitting them about 250 miles per hour at this point last week. He said some things that were just really, really solid. He pointed us to this fact that God is orchestrating all of these events. Stephen's stoning was not a mistake. We look at that as like, well, that's terrible. Yeah, but God has this beautiful thing of taking all things and working them out for the good, but he does it for those who love him. We're going to see that at the very end of today's message. Stephen was a man who loved God. And because he loved God, he actually was stoned for his faith. And because he was stoned and martyred for his faith, the gospel actually went then from that area of Jerusalem, and it just, it exploded. It spread. It went elsewhere, and that was God's intention. It's incredible. But what else we saw, and this is what Chris really did a nice job of hitting on so many of these different things, but hundreds of years before that, even hundreds of years before Christ came, God was still at work. He had prophesied through Daniel, if you remember, when they were exiled. And even that exile was very intentional, where you have Israel that's actually taken from their home. They're brought into Babylon. Then they're conquered by Persia. Then they're conquered by the Greeks. And then they're conquered by Rome, all lining up with Daniel's vision. But one of the things that Chris brought up, and he was absolutely right, when the Greeks conquered it, you know what was so significant about that? Is it brought in this almost universal language now so that the gospel, when it's written, which was written, much of the New Testament was all written in the language of Greek, so that now all of those people could now hear and understand what was going to be written about Jesus Christ. It's crazy. And what you have is this God who's been at work through the whole thing, and many times it feels like, God, where are you? Israel's exiled for 70 years in Babylon, and people are being thrown into fiery furnaces, people are being thrown in the lion's den. You can't help but ask the question, God, are you even doing anything? And the answer, yeah, he's doing way, way more, much more than we ever think, remember, fathom. God's at work. He's been at work the whole time, and he's got this beautiful picture of perfect timing. I was sharing a story just this morning with some people, and Spotify is a music app for those who are maybe not unaware. Spotify. Okay, what you do on Spotify is you download the app, you can listen to music on it, is what it works, but you can have an account. And so when you have an account, you're the primary account, so I can listen to what I want to. Well, at our house, we don't let our kids have accounts. So they have to use my account. Well, this was a number of years ago. I was working at a coffee shop writing my message, and I wanted to listen to something. I don't remember if it was trying to find a song that would go with the message or if I was actually wanting to listen to music while I was writing. It makes no difference. But I noticed that as I pulled up my Spotify, someone was listening on my account, and I could see what they were listening to. And I thought, oh, this would be fun. So I switched the song on them. I know I just put on a different song. And then I saw the song switched back to what it had been before. I was like, well, I'm going to have some fun with this. And so I switched it to the Barney song, you know. I love you, you love me. I switched it to the circus song. As I kept going back and forth, I kept doing all of these different goofiest songs I could think of. Just absolute. And I go home later that night. And I find the true story of what was happening. But apparently, as I was doing this, what it was is Isaac had my wife's iPad, and he was trying to play cool music for his friends. And instead, what he was getting was the Barney song and the circus music, and he was throwing a fist like, "Mom, something's wrong with this." I couldn't have orchestrated more perfect timing. I had no idea. But that's kind of what I'm talking about. It's like God's got this perfect timing thing, and we don't always see it. He knows what's going on. He's not surprised by the events of this last week. He's not surprised right now that we have a man by the name of Joe Biden who has been elected as president. He's not surprised. Does that mean that's the one he wanted? We don't know. I don't know what he wanted in that sense. But I know this. He's going to do what he's going to do. And we can't stop him. Okay? God's going to do what he's going to do, and we can't stop him. And I'm so encouraged that we can't stop him. Okay, remember that whole Nebuchadnezzar thing? You know, did God say, "I want this guy, I don't want him to crush my people"? Kind of, but not really in that sense. But did he use something really good in that? Absolutely. God is perfect. He's in control of this stuff, and we're going to see that coming through this morning. You remember the song? This was a number of years ago. I think it was 2005. I say that like I knew it, but I actually looked it up earlier to make myself look better. 2005. "Jesus, Take the Wheel." Remember that song? It was that song, like, if you were in an emotional state at the time, you'd get all teary, especially if you were a mother of young children and had just been in an accident or something. But the basis of the song is this woman who's driving, her life is falling apart, and as she's driving, she hits some bad spot on the road, and she slips out of control, and she throws her hands up and says, "Jesus, take the wheel." Here's what I'm convinced of. Jesus never let go of the wheel. I think he had it there the whole time. We used to have one of those trailers that you'd pull behind a bicycle. You know that? You hook it up to the bicycle, and then the kids would sit in there. It was double wide. So the kids would sit in there side by side, and they had this little bar that would come across with two steering wheels. So we'd slap that into place, and the kids would drive. Were they doing anything? Absolutely nothing. But they think they're driving. They had no control over it. I'm the one that's pedaling and taking them where they want to go. So as I'm pedaling, and we sometimes hit these rough, bumpy roads. "Dad, stop, it's too rough." "No, I'm not stopping. I got my workout to get in here right now. I'm not stopping for you and your whining and your bumpy road." They have no control. And sometimes, let's be honest, we're not far from sitting in a little bike trailer with a pretend steering wheel. We think we have control, but we've got no control. And instead of having that be a little bit of a downer for us, I hope that by the end of the morning, we can just like, wow, I am so thankful that I'm not in control and that Jesus has something way better for us. And so we're going to work through that. So I brought a Rubik's Cube today, and I'm getting a little bit off of my outline and such, and that's okay. So the Rubik's Cube, I see this as kind of like our world. It's all messed up, right? It's just a disaster. And I remember my grandmother had a Rubik's Cube that she would sit around. Hers was different. Hers was older. And hers actually, the Rubik's company got smart because they knew that people like me would peel the stickers off and put them back on where to solve it, right? So what they do now is they don't make them with stickers anymore. You try to peel these things off, you need to get some, paint thinner or something, just kind of wipe it all off and then get it repainted. But they've made them so you can't do that anymore. But what's interesting with the Rubik's Cube is I used to be able to spend some time, and I could sometimes get one face done. Okay, I'd get a face and it felt like I was accomplishing something. I'm going to actually give it to Isaac because he's way better and quicker at it than I am. So I would work at it, just to try to get one face done. And as I got one face done, then I would look at it, it's like, okay, well, now what's my next step? But to solve the Rubik's Cube, if anyone can, just out of curiosity, anyone can solve it? Aside from Isaac? There's a sequence. There's actually, each piece has a place that it needs to go. There is no other option for them. And unless someone's taking the Rubik's Cube and actually putting those pieces where they belong. Are you done? Well, just with this. Good. So this is what I would do. I would make this face. Oh, wow, I'm getting there. Look at Mom. I got a face done. But what I didn't realize is I'm putting them all in the wrong spot because those aren't in the right spot. They need to match up there too. Something different has to happen, Isaac. And so what the idea of it was is I would work on it, trying to put the pieces in place, and I couldn't do it. Sometimes I would get lucky enough, and I'd get the face done correctly where it needed to be done, and I would start working on the next side. And when I say lucky, I mean I was lucky. I didn't do it on purpose. I didn't really know what I was doing. How are we doing? Got it? So the idea is sometimes I'd get lucky enough, and I'd get that whole first layer done. To solve the Rubik's Cube, that's your first step. You have to get the first layer done. But then there's other steps. So what I would do at this point is I would get the first face done, and then I would start working on a full side. And so I'd get this one, and I'd get this one, and then I couldn't solve the rest beyond that. Sometimes, if I was really lucky, I could maybe get three sides, but that's not the right way to do it. That's putting things out of order. It won't work that way, at least for me. They say that someone can solve the Rubik's Cube in 20 moves or less every time. I am not that guy. Never will be. I've watched some of these online videos, and these guys are insane. And when I mean insane, they've totally lost their mind somehow and reprogrammed it to be able to do this stuff. They can do it so fast. I'm not that guy. I blame it on finger dexterity. That's not all it is. It's also my mind works much slower than theirs or what it used to. But the idea of it is you get that first layer, and then these pieces have to go into a certain spot. And when they go into that next spot, we get closer. This is our world right now. You got it? Thank you. So then the idea is you get the second layer done. And you still have this other layer to go. And as this world continues, what God is doing, whether we realize it or not, he's restructuring this thing and putting those pieces in place just like he said he would. And that's what's going on. I don't know why some of these things are happening in our culture. But I'll tell you this, God does. And he's putting some of these pieces in place. And what we're going to be doing here is we're going to be finishing up our Acts between today and next Sunday. And then we're transitioning right, in its perfect timing, into Revelation, which can be a very challenging book. And if you expect me to have all the Dr. David Jeremiah answers, I don't. So prepare yourself to be disappointed with that. But what you have, how are you doing? Well, you're quick. So God's working things out, and we keep getting closer and closer, and there's going to come a day. I just did this to show you that Isaac taught me how to do this. There's going to come a day when he's going to get it all finished. But until that point, we have to understand and recognize God's putting things in place. When this happens, we're going to be with him for eternity. But those who do not have a relationship with him, we need to be maybe a little bit afraid. And I hate to say that, but that's what we're going to be looking at today. So here's where we're going. Acts, I just gave you all my illustrations, so they're all done and out of the way. So now we're going to look at the scriptures for the most part. So we look at this Acts passage, and it's just astounding. We saw Paul over the last, if you've been following with us, the last couple of weeks, he's on trial. He's been in prison for 2 years. It's like, the idea is like, God, what are you doing? It's been 2 years. You told me, and I have this verse right off the get-go here, I believe. You told me that I'm going to be going to Rome to testify. This is kind of like this main driving theme for these last few chapters of the book of Acts. And this is what it says. The following night, the Lord stood near Paul. He's been threatened to be killed already. This is that moment where the mob had basically taken him away, and he was captured then by the Romans, the enemy who actually saved his life by arresting him, which again is God's perfect timing. They haul him away. He's in the barracks now, and he said, Paul has this vision with God, and God says to him, take courage, Paul. You have testified about me. We'll look at that word testified here in a little bit. Testified about me in Jerusalem. So you must also testify about me in Rome. He's given Paul a promise. You're going to Rome. If there was ever a time in Paul's life where he would have felt invincible, I think this is it. I think he probably felt like nothing can touch me. God says, I'm going to Rome. Until I get to Rome, from now until Rome, nothing can touch me. I don't care what you do. And he's in prison for 2 years. And from the outsider, looking at that, well, you said Paul's taking you to, or God's taking you to Rome, Paul. I said, he hasn't done that yet. Is God even real? And those are natural reactions. Those are our natural questions that we would ask. And so then what we find is Paul's taken. He's been in prison for 2 years. He's been under these different trials. He's first with Felix. Felix was the governor at that point, and the governor was kind of in charge of that smaller region. We're going to see Agrippa, who's a higher leader, higher up. Well, Felix was deposed. He was removed, and in place came Festus. And Festus is a new guy. He goes and he meets Paul. He hears what Paul has to say. And through this articulation, basically Paul ends up saying this really powerful statement. And it looks like it's going to end up being a mistake for him. And this is what the statement was. It says, after Festus had conferred and with the council, he declared, you have appealed to Caesar. To Caesar your goal. We know what Paul said. Fine, you're not listening to me. I'm going to Rome. You keep me under arrest here. Festus had said, well, maybe you should go back to the Jews. He said, no way, I'm not going back there. I want to go to see Caesar. Take me to Caesar. I'm going to Rome. I don't want to go back to Jerusalem. I want to go to Rome. And this appears, actually, it's going to be a mistake. We'll see that in here in a little bit. But this kind of leads up to where we're at. So Festus had spent some time with Paul. And in this process, Paul says, take me to see Caesar, take me to Rome. But because he was new, he didn't necessarily know what was going on, what he was doing. So this is what ends up happening. We start into the book of Acts then. Agrippa comes onto the scene. Agrippa would have been the king. He would have been the great-grandson of Herod the Great. Then Herod the Great was the one that tried to kill all the children when Christ was born. So he would have been the great-grandson of Herod the Great. He's the ruler of that region. He would have been in close contact with a lot of the Jews at that time, including the Pharisees and Sadducees. He would have been the one that would have appointed who the high priest was, which is very interesting that a Roman official, a Roman ruler is doing that, but they had control over it. The people have been going, again, this is oppression that we're under with Rome. And so Agrippa had some influence. He had some power in order to do some of this stuff for the high priest. He had a pretty good knowledge of the Jewish workings and the Jewish religious workings. We'll see that. So he arrives on the scene. He brings actually with him. He was living with his sister Bernice, or she was living with him as one or the other. There was actually accusations that it was an incestuous relationship. That's never been necessarily proven. But my mother's name is actually Bernice. And right from the get-go, when they named her Bernice, I don't think she realized it was biblical. My grandfather had said, we're going to name her Bernice, but we're going to call her Bunny. You know, that was just what it was. And so she can't stand the name Bernice. I'm sorry if you're named Bernice and I've offended you with that. That's not my goal. But my mother couldn't stand the name Bernice. And so, in fact, if you see her again and you call her Bernice, don't do that because that bugs Bunny. I know that was all a setup. That's all it really was. There's a true story, but it just was for the joke purpose, so thank you for that. I appreciate the mild laughter. Anyway, so here comes Agrippa with his sister Bernice. And this would have been normal. This would have been very common for that king to go in and check on his governors that would have been in that region, especially with Festus, who was new to the region. So this might have been an early meeting that Agrippa actually had with Festus. So Agrippa comes in and he meets with Festus, and Festus says, hey, I got to tell you about this one prisoner I've got. And he starts telling him about Paul. And this kind of intrigues Agrippa, and Agrippa says, I'd like to meet this Paul. And so they set it up. Okay, well, you want to meet Paul? By all means, we'll meet Paul. In fact, the irony of it is, Agrippa, is this Paul has asked to meet with Caesar. He's actually asked, and every Roman citizen would have had that right to do that. And he says he's actually asked to meet with Caesar, but I don't know what to send with a charge. You know, so if you get your mind on this, Festus has got to send Paul to Caesar because that's what Paul requested. But this is what he's accused of doing. This is what his crime is. And Festus is like, I don't have a crime for him. I don't know what he's guilty of. And so when Agrippa comes in and says, oh, by all means, I'd love you to meet with him, talk with him, and then you can help me come up with what am I going to charge him with. So that was kind of the agreement that they had. So here we go. So Agrippa and Bernice, they come in. It would have been the two of them. It would have been Festus there. There would have also been one leader for each regiment, and there would have been five regiments, which is 1,000 soldiers. So you have at least have five other Roman leaders in that way in charge of their commanders. So this is the kind of the group that is brought in to be with Paul to hear what Paul has to say. And so then Agrippa says to Paul, you have permission to speak for yourself. You have freedom. I'm giving you, by all means, say what you want to say. So Paul motioned with his hand and he began his defense. King Agrippa, look at the way that Paul is going to be addressing, in a sense, his enemy. Okay? We're going to hear Paul's defense. We've heard it before. This is the third time that we've heard Paul go through his whole story. But I want to emphasize again, as he comes through that whole story, it's his story. It's his testimony. Sometimes we ask ourselves, well, I don't know how to witness. I don't know how to share my faith. It's telling your story. That's all it is. It's saying how God has worked in you. That's it. And so sometimes we overthink it and we overstructure it. And I think the bottom line is Paul telling his story. That's his testimony. He's testifying to what God has done for him. Here we go. So, King Agrippa, I consider myself fortunate to stand before you today as I make my defense against all the accusations of the Jews. And especially so because you are well acquainted with all the Jewish customs. There's the affirmation. You know the Jewish customs that I grew up in. You know their customs and you know their controversies. Therefore, I beg you, listen to me patiently. I just ask you to listen. And then in verse 4, I've underlined some things. These are not necessarily for you as much as they are to help me as we go through this rather lengthy passage to be able to point out some things. So the Jewish people all know the way I have lived ever since I was a child, from the beginning of my life in my own country and also in Jerusalem. The reality of what he's getting at is these Jewish people, these ones who have accused me, they know me. They know what I was like. They know how I grew up. They know who my teachers were. It's like growing up in this community. If there's several of you that grew up in this community, some of you probably had the same teachers growing up. You know, Pastor Chris and I, we didn't go through Crown College at the same time, but we had some common professors throughout that time. We have this commonality. Oh, I know that. And so just by that very nature, they would have known Paul. They knew how he grew up. They would have known his family. They would have known his parents. So they knew him. They have known me for a long time, and they can, listen to this, this is just really good. They can testify. They have seen it. Because they have seen me and growing up in that way, they have a testimony to share, if they'll share it. If they're willing that I conform to the strictest sect of our religion, living as a Pharisee. These people that saw me, these Jews that are accusing me, they saw how I lived. They saw how I was persecuting people. They saw how I studied, and I knew everything there was to know. They knew my self-righteousness, though they wouldn't admit it to be self-righteousness. And now it is because of, I like this, Paul says it, now it is because of my hope. It's the fact that Paul has hope that he's on trial. You ever with someone, and you're kind of in a downer spot, and they're just the eternal optimist, and you find it's like, do you have to be so optimistic about everything? You know, when is there a time to just be down? You know, I don't want to be lifted up right now. I want to complain. You know, I'm complaining right now. I'm the pessimist. And here it is. When you're around that, Paul's hope is why he's on trial. It's the fact that I have this hope. It's beyond hope. And I want these people to see it. Oh, it's just going to be so good. So it's my hope in what God has promised our ancestors that I'm on trial. This is the promise, our 12 tribes hoping, these Jews are all hoping to see what it is that I am preaching, but they refuse to see it. Hoping to see fulfilled as they earnestly serve day and night. They're earnestly religious people, but they're missing the fact that the hope has been given. King Agrippa, it is because of this hope, this Jesus who is the hope, it is because of this Jesus that these Jews are accusing me. In other words, it's just a simple fact that I believe Christ is the answer. And that's what I'm being accused of doing wrong. Why should any of you consider it incredible that God raises the dead? That's a fair question. I look at that question and at first glance, I'm thinking, well, that would be pretty incredible. I don't think that makes sense. But he's asking it to people who would have known God and in their belief of the Jewish customs would have believed that God created the whole world. That's what they would have believed. So if God can create the whole world, if God can create mankind, if God can, as these ancestors believed, part the Red Sea, then is it so crazy to believe that God can also raise the dead? Paul's got a legitimate question. And it's one that, at first glance, well, yeah, it is incredible. Yeah, but he's done some awfully incredible things, too. There's no reason why we couldn't think that. I, too, was convinced that I ought. You remember a few weeks ago when we were in the book of Acts, we hit that word ought. And that word ought in here just means like it's not described as a good idea, but it's so intrinsic to you and what it is, who you are, that it just naturally flows from you. right? So if you're a follower of Christ and you want to testify, it's so part of you, you can't help it. They should go together is the idea behind it. It's not like a good idea. You follow what I'm saying there? There's a difference in that understanding. In our English language, we lose some of that, especially with that a word like that. He said, I too was convinced that I ought to do all that the law taught, to do all that was possible to, look at this, oppose the name of Christ. And we see a contrast to Paul now, but he says, I did everything. I was so adamant. I was so self-righteous. I was so focused that the law was the right way, and I had to hold people to the law. I was so stuck on that I would do anything. It was my duty to oppose anyone who said otherwise. And that is just what I did in Jerusalem on the authority of the chief priests. I put many of the Lord's people in prison, and when they were put to death, I said, good for you. Many a time I went from one synagogue to another to have them punished. I tried to force them to blaspheme. I was so obsessed. What are you obsessed with? What consumes you? It could be your family. It's not necessarily a bad thing in a way, depending on how you take it. It could be football. It could be the Vikings, but probably not this year. If you are, I really feel bad for you because it's a rough year to be a Viking fan. But there's a lot of things that we find ourselves obsessed with. Paul, at this point, was absolutely obsessed. You know what obsessed? It's just you're totally taken in by this. Like, I can't do anything, but this is all I can think about. Most young men who have found a lovely girl are obsessed, whether they will admit it or not. And they do everything they can for this young lady, trying to woo this young lady into believing that they're not as bad as they really are. And in doing so, they do some things that's just like, what's wrong with you? Well, I'm kind of obsessed. That's what it boils down to. They're so obsessed. Paul was obsessed with persecuting these Christians. You know what that means? He hated them. Paul hated all of the Christians. He couldn't stand them. It was probably a very political feeling that he had even at that point. As a self-righteous Jew and these grace-preaching believers, like, oh, what's wrong with you? You think you're better than me? And there's just this aggravation, maybe even arrogance that would come out. He was obsessed. He hated them, and he was obsessed with persecuting them, that I even hunted them down in foreign cities. I wanted every one of them dead. On one of these journeys, I was going to Damascus with the authority and commission of the chief priests. About noon, which we talked about this a few weeks ago, noon, middle of the day, King Agrippa, as I was on the road, I saw a light from heaven brighter than the sun blazing around me and my companions. That's got to be an awfully bright light if at midday, noon, the light suddenly gets brighter. It's like the opposite of the solar eclipse. Blazing around me and my companions, we all fell to the ground, and I heard a voice saying to me in Aramaic, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? It is hard for you to kick against the goads. You know what a goad is? Basically, it's a pointy stick. And so what would happen is you'd have the idea of you goad something along. You take this pointy stick and you kind of direct the ox or the cow or whatever it is that you're leading. And you kind of poke him to get him to move the way that you want to. Well, what does it mean to kick against the goads? Basically, it means like, stop, that hurts. And you actually kick against it. And by kicking against it, are you doing harm to the one who holds the goad? No, you're only doing harm to yourself. I remember in elementary school, there was a kid with a pencil. He had just sharpened the pencil. And I thought it would be funny if I took and I knocked the pencil out of his hand. I took and as he's walking by, I went, wah! And the pencil dug into my hand and the lead broke off. You know, that's kind of the idea of kicking against the goads. Did it do him any harm? No. It does me the harm. And likewise, here's Paul. He's persecuting Christians. He's persecuting Christ. And Jesus asked him, why are you kicking against the goads? In other words, why do you keep pressing against this? All you're doing is hurting yourself. You're doing yourself more harm. There comes a time when we have to just give up and submit and say, okay, you win. You with the goad, you're winning. Some of us, I fear, whether you're in person or online, we tend to kick against the goad. We know the direction that we want to go, and perhaps it's the Lord that's goading us or nudging us in a different direction. It's like, no, I can't go that way, and we continue to kick against the goad, and are we doing God any harm? We're doing ourselves the harm. You follow that? That's the imagery that is being pointed out here. So then Paul asks, he said, then I asked, who are you, Lord? I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting, which is a very astounding statement and needed to be in there, because here's Paul, who approved of the death of Christ. And now in order for these words to happen, in order for him to hear it, you know what that means? Jesus isn't dead. This is a huge piece, and that's why Paul will preach the resurrection. Okay? So now get up, stand on your feet. I have appeared to you to appoint you as a servant, as a witness. That's to testify, to tell others of what you've seen. If you want to know how to share your faith, to tell others of what you've seen. That's it. And what you will see of me. What's interesting, it strikes me in this passage here too. Leading up to that very verse, it feels like God had every right to let Paul have it. You know, when he says, why are you kick against the goads? You're only doing yourself harm. I've had it with you. You're done. Squash. But he doesn't do it. What does he do? He shows him some incredible and amazing grace. I'm always so encouraged when I look at how crummy Paul really was and how much grace he received. If that doesn't give us hope, I don't know what does. It's really, really sweet. So he says, I will rescue you from your own people and from the Gentiles. Paul probably didn't even realize he needed rescuing until this point, obviously, because he's going to do something following Christ that's going to be really, really bad in light of the persecution he will then receive from the Gentiles. He says, I'm sending you to them to open their eyes and to turn them from darkness to light and from the power of Satan to God. Catch that, to God. You know, we look at a passage like Isaiah 5:20, and I'm not going to get the quote exactly right, but this is a point when the prophet speaks to God's people and he says, woe to you who call evil good and good evil, who call darkness light and light darkness. And what we have here is there's a role that Paul has, and there's a role that we have, and it's to point people to the light. It's to point people back to Christ. There's going to be a question I'm going to ask at the end, at the very end. It's something that I remember Pastor Phil asking a number of years ago. And at the time that he asked me that question, I was like, yeah. I mean, I could answer it, but it didn't penetrate me like it has now. So we are to direct them from the power of Satan and back to God so that they may receive forgiveness of sins and a place among those who are sanctified by faith in me. So then, King Agrippa, I was not disobedient to the vision. I had the vision. I had to do what it was. It was something that was intrinsic. I ought to do it. First to those in Damascus, then to those in Jerusalem and all Judea, and then to the Gentiles. I preached that they should repent and turn to God. That is a key for this morning. And to demonstrate their repentance by their deeds. You like that? Demonstrate their repentance by their deeds. Sometimes I think we get mixed up and we're like, well, the deeds will show whether you're, you know, like that's your salvation. That's not it. When we choose to put our faith in Christ, it's reflected by now how I love. That was a whole Advent series. That is why some Jews seized me in the temple courts. He was there worshiping at the time. That's why some Jews seized me and tried to kill me. But God has helped me to this very day. That's that perfect time, and we talked about it right at the beginning of the service. So I stand here and I testify. I tell you what it is that I have seen, what it is that I have experienced, to small and great alike. I don't care who you are, whether you're poor or whether you're rich. It makes no difference to me. I'm going to tell you and I'm going to testify to this amazing grace that I have received. I'm going to tell you exactly what I saw. So then, King Agrippa, I skipped that one. Hold on. There we go. I'm hitting the wrong button. There we go. I am saying nothing beyond what the prophets and Moses said would happen. In other words, everything that I'm preaching, the prophets said would happen. We just have chosen not to believe it. That the Messiah would suffer, and as the first to rise from the dead, would bring the message of light to his own people and to the Gentiles. At this point, I like this. At this point, Festus, the governor, he rises up and says, interrupted Paul's defense right in the middle of his statement. He says, "You're crazy. You've lost your mind. This doesn't make any sense. This is absurd." And he shouted it and says, "Your great learning is driving you insane." And Paul's response is, and notice the gentleness in Paul's response. He says, "I'm not insane, most excellent Festus. What I am saying is true and it's reasonable." And this is where it gets really good. Look at this. Agrippa, the enemy of God, standing before, he's basically the one that Paul needs to have save him, if you will. And the king is familiar with these things, Paul says this to Festus. The king knows. Agrippa knows these things and I can speak freely to him. I am convinced that none of this has escaped his notice. He's been well aware. This hasn't been done in a corner. This hasn't been done in secret because it was not done in a corner. King Agrippa, do you believe the prophets? All of this stuff that you have been taught since you were a kid, not because you're a Jew, but because you're in charge of the Jews, you know all this stuff. Do you believe the prophets? And then Paul says, I know that you do. You too, Agrippa, are believing what the Jews have been teaching, that there's going to be coming a Messiah. Paul believes totally that Agrippa believes it. And then Agrippa says, this is my favorite part. Do you think that you can make me a Christian so quickly? You know what that tells me? It tells me a couple of things. One, it tells me that Agrippa is wrestling with what Paul is saying. Something has struck him. He knows what Paul is after. It's like, you think you can convert me to Christianity so quickly? This is just our first conversation. Paul's response is so telling. He said, whether it's a short time or long, it makes no difference. Short time or long, you're missing the point. Oh, look at this. I pray to God that not only you, but all who are listening to me today may become what I am, which is a Christian. I'll talk more about that in a second, except for these chains. That's an evangelistic statement. That is not a statement that says you need to turn to Christ or you're going to hell. There's a different flavor to that. And I want to be careful with how I say that, but you got to hear what Paul is saying. You know what Paul is saying is, Agrippa, I care about you. I care about you so much. I want you to fall in love with God. I want you to look to God and understand what he has offered to you. Not only you, but I want everyone else who hears this message to do the same thing. Paul's not approaching him out of trying to guilt him. Paul's approaching him out of exactly what we've talked about throughout the month of December. He's approaching him with not only love for who Agrippa is, but because he loves Christ so deeply. Paul loves Jesus. That is the root of what we're seeing here. The king rose, and with him the governor and Bernice. Don't call her Bernice. And those sitting with them, after they left the room, they began saying to one another, this man is not doing anything that deserves death or imprisonment. In other words, what it looks like they're saying we should let him go. And this is where it looks like Paul has sealed his own death and demise, which in a way he has, but it's because of God's plan. Paul, the last statement is, Agrippa said to Festus, this man could have been set free if he had not appealed to Caesar. But our hands are tied. He's got to go to Caesar. You know what's going to happen? Spoiler alert. Caesar's going to kill him, or he's going to die in Rome. It looks like Paul has done himself a disservice by sending himself to Caesar. But that's not the point, because he's putting those pieces of that puzzle together right where they need to be, and this is exactly in part of God's plan. So sometimes what seems like, oh, this is terrible, this is awful, is actually part of what God wants to do, and it might be uncomfortable. But it's good, because God's in control. You know, the beauty of the Rubik's Cube, when it's all messed up, it takes someone to solve it. Likewise with our world, we're the ones that messed it up. It's going to take someone to solve it. We think that mankind can solve it. Well, guess what? We're wrong. Only God, and he will. God, Chris talked about the last 2 weeks. God is sovereign. So there's three questions I want to ask. The first two are going to be answered with the same answer. The third one is going to be a little bit more poignant directly to us. But three questions. One is, what is it that keeps Paul doing what he's doing? What is it that keeps him in Rome for these 2 years? I mean, obviously he's in prison, but he could have defended himself. He could have gotten out of it. I'm convinced of that. But what is it that keeps him there? And what is it that makes him, that leads him to talk to Agrippa and share that message the way that he does? What is it that leads him to testify? Is it guilt and obligation? It's not. The answer to that question is, both those questions are the same. I'm convinced that the reason that Paul is able to do what he's doing and the reason that he's able to speak boldly to Agrippa the way that he's speaking is simply because he loves Jesus deeply. He loves him. And that's changed his life. I fear that sometimes we look at becoming a Christian as being just saying the right words. That's not the point. I know there's value in professing with your mouth and believing in your heart that Jesus Christ is Lord. I'm not diminishing that, so please don't misunderstand. However, we are called to love God. We are called to love him. Paul loves him, which leads me to the third question. And this is the one I remember Pastor Phil asking years ago. And I remember when I heard the question, it's like, oh, well, yeah, of course I do. I'm a Christian. But it's hit me a little bit different over the last number of years. And the question is, do you love Jesus? Do you love him? Do you deeply love him? Paul's able to do what he does because he loves Christ. He doesn't have to think about what it is that I'm going to do, how I'm going to do it. It boils down to this. If you love Jesus Christ, if you have, I love him. If you love him, you can't help but allow your life to go where he wants you to go. Do you see that? I mean, it's just natural. If I love my wife and I know what she needs, do I love her if I'm not doing it? No, that doesn't make sense. Do you love Jesus? And I'm talking, do you deeply love him? That's what we're called to. Sometimes we think, well, I'm called to do this and that and the other. Yeah, I get that, but that's all secondary. The first and foremost, do you love him? Look at a couple of these verses and we'll wrap it up. Jesus replied, anyone who loves me will obey my teaching. My Father will love them, and we will come to them and make our home with them. Anyone who does not love me will not obey my teaching. These words you hear are not my own. They belong to the Father who sent me. Don't have a lot of time to get into this, but this is the final verse. And it says, and we know, and we've heard this verse before, I think we have oftentimes misunderstood or misquoted it even. We know that on all things God works for the good, but then there's the key of those who love him. This verse really isn't intended for those who don't have a love relationship with him. This promise isn't for those who don't love Christ. I know that's kind of hard to hear sometimes. And who have been called according to his purpose. Do you love Jesus? In our response to what's going on in our culture, I think our love for him will lead us to pray. Our response to what's going on in our culture, I don't have all the answers, but I do know this. I want to testify to the love that I have for Christ and the love that he has for me. I don't know where that will lead, but I do know that that's what God wants for us. I'm going to invite Lane, and we're going to worship. Reflect on this reality. God's in control of what's going on. We can trust him. Do you love him? We tend to trust the people that we love. Do you love him?